This is Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is supported by the worker owners at Firestorm Books & Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm also features organic coffee and milks, homemade baked goods, vegan sandwiches, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com. The first half of this week's show will feature the second part of my conversation with Maria, an American anarchist and former student who's been living in Montreal and participating in the student-led upheavals of late 2011 and early 2012. In part one, Maria set the stage describing the history of the student movement and strikes from 1968 through to the riots that erupted at Victoriaville on May 6th of this year. The second half of the show will feature music concerned with coal extraction and the natural devastation that it leaves behind. I hope you all enjoy. If you want to hear the first half of the show, the original first half of the conversation with Maria, check out archive.org and search Burst's Final Straw and Montreal. So I'd like to make a few updates for folks about recent show topics. From the Cleveland For Justice Campaign's website comes this statement, quote, "On May 1st, 2012, five men were arrested near Cleveland, Ohio, accused of trying to destroy an area bridge with explosives. These guys were manipulated and entrapped by an FBI informant who was paid $6,000 for the job. On July 25th, 2012, Anthony Hain formally entered into a cooperating plea with a minimum sentence of 16 to 20 years. The Cleveland For Justice is a support group of friends and family who want to make sure that the remaining four, Brandon, Connor, Doug, and Joshua, have the best legal representation they can get so that they can be exonerated and come home as soon as possible. Their trial is scheduled to begin on September 17th, so time is short. So if you can help raise funds for the crew or want to learn more about the case, because they do need legal aid, please check out the website cleveland5justice.org. In an update from the resistance to grand juries in the Pacific Northwest comes this statement from the website saynothing.noblogs.org, and also you can check out that site for great report backs on solidarity actions alongside the grand jury resistors who refuse to be intimidated. So here's the quote. "Grand juries and the repression surrounding them are focused specifically on isolation in an attempt to strike fear into the hearts of anarchists and all those associated with them. Whether you are close to those involved in the recent wave of Pacific Northwest repression or not, its impact has most likely touched your region. In an attempt to counter that fear and isolation, the days of August 24th to August 31st are being called as a week of solidarity with anarchists in the Pacific Northwest. Let's turn that fear back toward our common enemy and drive impact of their repression into expressions of solidarity. Consider acting in ways that communicate the passion for freedom that those in the Northwest have continued to express by their refusal to cooperate with the state's witch hunt. Remember that the next grand jury hearing is on Thursday, August 30th, at the federal courthouse in downtown Seattle. If you live in the area, please come to the courthouse at 700 Stewart Street at 12 noon for a demonstration outside. If you live outside the area, consider planning a solidarity demonstration in your city or an event about grand jury resistance. May their attempts at repression only make our aim stronger." For anyone in the Denver, Colorado area, on August 17th, the Denver Anarchist Black Cross and Terror Down Prisons will be holding a benefit concert for the Tinley Park Five and other anti-fascist prisoners. This event will happen at the Old Curtis Street Bar in Denver. The show is 18 and over only, and the doors will open at 8 p.m. The performers include Dripfed, Carpe Canem, and Plan B Rejects. For more information, check out the flyer at rockymountainantifa.blogspot.com. After 2 weeks of inspirational resistance and solidarity actions on the outside, as well as the strike spreading to two other prisons in North Carolina, on August 4th, it was announced that the prisoners at North Carolina's Central Prison voted Unit 1 voted to end their hunger strike. To quote from Chapel Hill Prison Books website at prisonbooks.info, a few days ago, several members of the Strong eight men sentenced to ICON for staging a work protest in Central Prison's kitchens in December of 2011 were sentenced to 6 more months of solitary confinement by the warden himself. At a July 25th hearing, these men, who had no infractions or write-ups in the past 6 months, were recommended for general population. This ruling was just directly overruled, however, by Warden Lassiter, who, in the words of one of the Strong Eight, quote, told the DCA board to keep us an icon as an example. The men are now stuck in isolation for no apparent reason, at least according to the policy, unquote. And one last piece of news, a really great piece of news. Christopher French, who was arrested during the NATO protests and accused of assaulting an officer, is currently out on bail. Chris's support website posted on August 6th that, quote, sometime in the past week, Chris was pulled into a room by 2 prison guards who handcuffed his arms behind his back and used their batons, fists, and boots to beat him for an extended period of time. They also used pepper spray at point-blank range for several minutes while holding his eyes open. This was done in response to Chris not tucking in his shirt, supposedly, unquote. To hear that Chris is currently not in those circumstances is definitely relieving. Chris will still be in need of legal funds, as well as pressure will be needed to be applied to those imprisoning him in Illinois. For more information on the case, you can go to freedomforchrisfrench.wordpress.com. In the face of increased repression of students by the Montreal government, we also see an increasingly intense resistance at and beyond the manifactions, including the smoke bombings of metro stations that shut down transit in the city. No one was hurt during these actions, but 3 accused activists were arrested and banished from the island, dubbed terrorists. Let's have Maria continue.
On May 14th, Lim Beauchamp, the Minister of Education, quits. And some people are pretty excited about this. Some people are obviously a little bit more reserved about whether or not they think it'll change anything. The person, I believe, who gets her job was the finance minister, whose name I think is Michelle Courchez, but I could be wrong. And after that, there are still a lot of schools fighting injunctions pretty intensely. And on the 18th of May, Law 78 passes. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that later, but another thing that happens on May 18th is that an anti-mask bylaw passes in Montreal. So this means that you can't wear a mask at a demo without facing a specific ticket for wearing a mask at a demo. So before this, if you get arrested, the way it works in Montreal is the cops generally try and mass arrest people. They're really into that. They've been sanctioned by the UN for, not sanctioned, but yelled at by the UN for relying on mass arrest tactics as a way to stop people from going to demos. And so they'll kettle everyone in, like all of a sudden people will be at a demo and realize that there's a line of cops in front of them, a line of cops behind them, and no escape on either side of the street. And then the kettle slowly closes as more and more and more cops join the kettle. And then they put zip ties on everyone, put them on STM buses, and bus them out to processing centers at different points around the city. One interesting thing that happened at the time was that the bus drivers were refusing to drive these buses anymore because as the buses were being driven through the city, people were like, knew that it was all students being stuck on those buses and were trying to do things to the buses they were driving by. And the bus drivers don't just drive around detainees after mass arrests, they also drive the cops from location to location, so you'll see buses that are just like full of cops. So the bus drivers union says they won't drive these buses with the cops in them anymore, but the cops just find specialists to drive those buses. But it was a pretty cool thing to see happen in the news. But anyways, the mask law passes, Law 78 passes. There's a whole bunch of things to remember about Law 78. One is that it makes it illegal for anyone to participate in a demonstration that has more than 50 people at it, where the organizers did not give the cops their route and the length of time that they think their demo will happen. Law 78 also ends the semester for all the university and Cégep students, so it's essentially a lockout. Like, the students can't go to, they can't, there are no classes happening, there's nothing to picket, the schools are all shut down, they're all locked shut. Law 78 also meant that really intense fines could get imposed on student unions who were trying to organize a strike, including individuals within a union trying to organize a strike. It could still result in really intense fines. That weekend, the 18th of May weekend, that Law 78 passes, I think it passed on a Friday, And the mask law passed either the Thursday or the Friday. That was the weekend of the Anarchist Book Fair in Montreal. And the Friday and Saturday and Sunday night demos were really intense. Friday night, there were Molotov cocktails at the night demo, which was a first in a long time for Montreal. And on Sunday night, there was an anti-capitalist bloc of people who had organized themselves pretty well. And that demo ended with 300 people getting arrested, I believe. But it also saw some really cool things happen, like people breaking open kettles. So there's a video online. This is all video. There should just be like a video timeline of the student movement that someone can make. But there's a kettle. You can see these people are stuck in a kettle. There's a line of cops to the north of them and to the south of them. But they realize that the line of cops to the north of them doesn't have as many cops in it as it could. So they organize themselves really fast to just charge the cops. And they charge the cops, and something between like 75 and 100 people escaped that kettle. The people who were left in the kettle got really coughed up, but the people who managed to leave made it to the end of the night. I'm sure some of them ended up getting arrested in the big kettle that happened at the end of the night, but seeing kettles get broken open wasn't something that people had seen before, so that was pretty exciting.
Another thing that you had said about the law, too, was that it outlawed protests within a certain amount of feet of the school, or meters of the school.
Yeah. I don't know exactly how many meters of a school it is, but that made the pickets explicitly illegal, because those were demonstrations in front of a university or a sejup. On May 22nd, it's the, let's see, March, April, three-month anniversary of the strike. And so Laws of Need has just been passed. People are really pissed. The same thing's happening that happened before, where you've got really confrontational demos for like three or four nights, and then all of a sudden there's thousands more people in the streets and things calm down a bit. This time it's a daytime demo, and 500,000 people show up for this demo. It's huge. Someone was telling me that they think it's the biggest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. There were two routes that day for the demo. The demo was planned by the class, and the class didn't give the cops their route. But the CSN, I believe, a union in Montreal, had also helped organize the demo, and they had given the cops their route. So the demo starts in this big plaza sort of thing in the... It's called the Quartier des Spectacles, like the quarter, the like neighborhood of spectacles in Montreal. And it starts there, goes up a street, and then you could either turn left or you could turn right. And turning right was the route that had been given to the cops, and the majority of people at the demo, the vast, vast majority of people at the demo turned left. There was also a small anti-capitalist contingent at that demo that managed to exploit the fact that the demo was huge and moving in a big square and just, like, wreak a bit of havoc in the middle of the square because the cops couldn't get in through the demo to do anything to them. The next night, at the night demo on May 23rd, there was the biggest kettle I've ever heard of in Montreal. There were 500-some people all stuck in the same kettle on one corner in downtown Montreal. And then after that, sometime in the week after that, the casseroles start. So the casseroles are a tradition that comes from Chile. I believe, Bruce, you did a little bit more research on these. And it's where people take pots and pans out of their house and walk out into their neighborhoods. In Montreal, it was working. People would walk out into the streets of their neighborhoods and just walk up and down their block, hitting a spoon against a pot until a bunch of their neighbors had come out and joined them. The noise levels become deafening. And in some neighborhoods, they organized themselves to have banners in front of their casseroles. So there was a neighborhood called Villeray, and they had a sign that said in English, like, Villeray disobeys, meaning Villeray disobeys Law 78. And so the casseroles are happening in different neighborhoods all over the city. One of the popular slogans that comes out at the time of the casseroles is La grève étudiante, la lutte populaire. So the strike is a student strike, but the struggle is a popular struggle, and people really start pushing that. Another thing that happens at the time of the casseroles is neighborhood assemblies. So I believe the first one happened in a neighborhood called Rosemont Petit Patrie, which is in the northeast of Montreal. And they call the neighborhood assembly, the basis for a lot of the neighborhood assemblies is that people are against Law 78 and in support of the student strike, and then are trying to create more autonomous infrastructure in their neighborhoods. So what they're actually called in Montreal is Les Assemblées Populaires Autonomes du Quartier, so the popular autonomous neighborhood assemblies. And they've been happening in maybe like 13 different neighborhoods on the island of Montreal, and then in three different suburbs of Montreal, perhaps. I'm not sure. There's a lot of them. And the neighborhood assemblies are pretty cool in terms of trying to build power in a neighborhood way. One of the reasons why I think they started happening is because the students had been locked out of their schools and all went back to the neighborhoods where they live. So some neighborhoods where there's really strong neighborhood assemblies, a lot of the participants are students. But there's also a huge range of participants in all of the neighborhood assemblies. One other thing to mention, at the time, I think there was a lot of debates happening, and still, this is all really new for a lot of anarchists in town. So there are a lot of debates happening around the casseroles, around the neighborhood assemblies, about how easily co-optable they could be. One of the ministers provincially, whose name is Bachon, came out and said that the casseroles are great. They're a really great break from the more confrontational nighttime demos. The provincial government could very easily start doing, I mean, they already do the good protester, bad protester dynamic that we've seen in lots of other places. And they started doing this really intensely around the casseroles because they realized that the casseroles had really huge popular support. So they start trying to do this divide between the really nice casseroles and the really terrible night demos. And, you know, people have tried to start thinking about, okay, how do we make the neighborhood assemblies not as easily co-optable as the casseroles? And one of the ways that that tried to happen in one of the neighborhoods in Montreal was that people came together in their neighborhood to go to the next big event of the student strike, which was the Grand Prix. So the Grand Prix in Montreal is a Formula One race that happens. It's like a car race that happens on this island that's just off of the island of Montreal. But there's huge parties that happen around the Grand Prix in the streets of downtown Montreal. So downtown Montreal is a huge haven for festivals in the summertime. There's lots of streets that get blocked to traffic to have concerts, to have different shows, to have all sorts of things. So the Grand Prix was one of the first to start in Montreal. And that weekend, a bunch of neighbors from one neighborhood marched from their neighborhood to a meetup of people who had decided to disrupt the Grand Prix. So that was kind of cool. And other thing that things that happened that weekend, the Grand Prix saw the SQ in the streets of Montreal again, and the SPVM, the Montreal cops, reacting really intensely to people being at the Grand Prix events in downtown Montreal, mostly people who tried to get out to the Formula One race on this island on that Sunday, I believe it was, were getting turned around at the metro if they had a red square on. So I didn't talk about this yet. The red squares are usually made from felt, but they're little red squares that people pin to their shirts that are a visible sign of support for the student strike. And it was something that started in 2005. I think it comes from a French saying that means squarely in the red and is against student debt and all that kind of stuff, but has come to be a symbol of the student movement. And because the student movement has generalized so intensely in Montreal, it's come to be a symbol of this struggle that involves way more people than just the students, that isn't just talking about the student strike anymore, it's talking about all sorts of things. So that's sort of the symbol of the struggle, is this red square. So the cops were turning around anyone who was wearing a red square who were trying to get out to the island where this race was happening. And it isn't just this racetrack on the island. There's, like, little beaches. There's a whole amusement park that's out there. But if you had a red square on that day, they weren't going to let you on the island. They were going to turn you around on the metro and then threaten you with arrest if you didn't leave the metro station and stay away from the metros for the rest of the day. Another thing that happened that weekend was people... So you couldn't tell the difference. There were tons of people in downtown Montreal. You couldn't tell the difference between who was a student protester, because people were good at not putting their squares on in certain instances, who was a student protester, and who was a Grand Prix fan. So the cops can't keep the student protesters out of the downtown core because they can't tell who's who. So one thing that kept happening that was really funny was that the cops would rush the demo as people were, like, in the night demo, and people would melt up onto the sidewalk, blend in with everyone else on the sidewalk, and the cops would be standing in the intersection stopping traffic themselves until they got bored and then decided to march away. They would march away of, like, a block or two away, and people would take the intersection again. It all was happening at one main intersection. People would take the intersection again, pull out their pots and pans from their backpacks, start yelling student chants in the streets and all other sorts of chants that were happening during the student strike. And then they would hold that corner until the cops rushed again, and then melt back up onto the sidewalk. And then the cops would leave again, and then they would go back into the street. It happened, like, 4 or 5 times in one night. It was pretty funny. And, yeah, on June 13th, there was the sabotage of a railway line in Farmham, Quebec. That was when the International Economic Forum of the Americas was happening in Montreal. There were also big demos against that, although none of them were super confrontational. But they were pretty exciting, pretty big.
What did that sabotage look like? What was it exactly?
I'm not sure. There's a communique about it online somewhere.
Did they catch anyone that they're attributing it to?
Nope. So after June 13th, I don't have any specific dates for anybody, but where we're at now is that people are, as far as I can tell, people seem to be taking a break until August. So one of the things that Law 78 mandated was that there be a special semester. So never in the history of Quebec student strikes have people lost a semester due to being on strike. And so they're trying to save this semester. And the way they've figured out to try and save it is to force students to go back to school starting August 13th with the cégeps. And the cégeps are starting August 13th, but start any time between the 13th and the 17th. They'll have like a month and a half where they have to finish that winter semester that they started but didn't finish. And then the universities start their special semester at the end of August. So most of these schools still have strike mandates. And if they don't, they're going to have general assemblies coming up soon. And you'll be able to follow online whether or not they decide to stay on strike. And a lot of them will. So there's a convergence that's been called for Montreal starting on August 13th and going until the 17th. There's a website called Blacons La Hausse, that was the old one. The new one is Blacons La Rentrée, which is BLOQUONSLARENTREE.com, I believe. And that's where you can go to figure out information about the convergence. A lot of neighborhood assemblies are trying to mobilize support in the neighborhoods for the picket lines. The picket lines are going to start again on August 13th, and they're going to be really intense because the cops don't need any reason to try and squash picket lines, but now they have this legalized way that they can justify what they're doing through Law 78. Even though Law 78 has been really intensely criticized, and the Quebec Human Rights Commission recently came out and said that they think it's unconstitutional. But the courts are refusing to hear the case until January, so we won't know till January if the law is going to be struck down. So for now it stands, and once the picket lines start again, it'll stand, and it's scaring a lot of people. So we'll see what's going to happen in August.
So is it with that call-out, is that a general call-out for people beyond the communities within Quebec to try to make it in?
Yeah, people are organizing billeting. The website's in English and French, I believe. People are organizing billeting and trying to make it a good place for out-of-towners to come if they want to come in and help with the picket lines. Although, I mean, it's important to keep in mind the ways that the Montreal cops act, the fact that it could be really easy to get arrested during these strikes, or during these picket lines when they start up again in August. So people who are thinking of coming need to keep that in mind.
It seems like it would also be the Canadian governments seem very good at blocking up access to people getting in from the U.S. who they think might be troublemakers.
Yeah, I heard a lot of stories around the time of the Anarchist Book Fair of friends trying to get up from the U.S. who were having difficulties getting into Canada. Another thing that's happening right now, if I can add this really quick, is that the provincial government is threatening to have an election at the beginning of September. And one of the things they're hoping to do is completely deflate any momentum that this movement has going for it, by funneling that into an election campaign. So the neighborhood assemblies are trying to be strategic about this. People are trying to start thinking about ways to funnel energy from the elections into the neighborhood assemblies and tell people that that's the place where you can make decisions for yourselves, not necessarily in the elections. There's also rumors of a general strike. One of the unions in Montreal sort of has a strike mandate. I don't quite understand how it works, but...
And this is a healthcare union for the most part?
It's called CSN, and I know they represent the hospital workers. I don't know who else they represent, but it's a bunch of people across the province. And they've gotten, from what I've heard, they've gotten a strike mandate from the grassroots as a reaction to new user fees that are getting imposed on the healthcare system. But their union president wrote into the clause of the strike, "We will go on strike when it is deemed appropriate." So they have yet to deem it appropriate. Who knows if they will, but that's something that could happen in terms of the strike spreading into the working sector of Quebec and people going on strike in solidarity, not just in solidarity with the students, but for these broader reasons, for things about rising healthcare fees, for things about, I mean, a lot of things that are changing in Quebec and across the country in Canada.
A lot of anarchists have taken note of and been critical, you've said, of certain personalities within the student movement that seem to be taking up a lot of space and even taking a bunch of power, presenting themselves as faces to the media and sort of feeding into the media need for talking heads. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. In Quebec, francophones have coined the phrase imagisme, which, if I understand it correctly, is about these spokespeople for the class specifically trying to have a really good image in the media, and so saying certain things that they might not have said in the past. It's important to keep in mind that the structure of the class is such that the class spokespeople are only talking, like, they're only supposed to be explaining what has been voted on in general assemblies to the media or to, you know, the premier, because they're also the people who go to the negotiations. But the way it's been happening in Montreal, it's partly the fault of the media, not necessarily the fault of this person himself, but the one of the spokespersons for class, Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, has been getting a lot of media FaceTime. The media love him, and they want to put him on this pedestal as the leader of the student movement, and some people criticize him for not doing enough to stop that from happening. So people are bringing out this imagisme thing and saying that class is too concerned with its image. Gabrielle has been saying things in the media that people can construe as trying to override things that are happening at the general assemblies. There's a female person who is also a class spokesperson who hasn't been in the media as much as Gabrielle, and people have been talking about that a lot because class has a feminist mandate. That's, I mean, they have a whole committee, like a feminist committee that operates and talks about sexism within the class, sexism within the student movement, so that's something they're super into talking about, but the way the media has been portraying class through only representing Gabrielle has been erasing a lot of the more radical things that class does.
So how have anarchists who are outside of the student movement been interacting with this? What kind of critiques have come out from anarchists in terms of the relationship between anti-austerity and human rights and human needs and dignity on one side, and then on the other, the demand for the abolition of government?
So I'm just going to talk about how I've experienced this because I haven't been in school for this whole strike. And it's super alienating to be going to demos where all of the chants are about how tuition needs to be lower and how we need to abolish student debt and things like that. And it was more exciting to be going to some of the demos where there were majority anti-capitalist chants. That was pretty sweet. But in terms of your question, I think a lot of people who've been thinking, not just anarchists, but a lot of radicals who've been trying to think really hard about how these neighborhood assemblies can work, have been confronting that question of, like, we think this is about so much more than anti-austerity. It's always been about more than that. And sometimes when our language is all about anti-austerity, people think that that's all we're about. So trying not to talk about things in that way, and instead being really careful about talking about neighborhood power, talking about building infrastructure within our neighborhoods to better support each other. One cool thing that one of the neighborhood assemblies started doing is having a legal support committee so that people who aren't students can help support anyone who's been arrested at any of these demos. And they've been really clear about, like, we're not going to do the good protester, bad protester thing. People get charged with whatever the cops want to charge them with. We're going to support anyone who's been arrested during this strike. And they've been really good at organizing rides out to the centers where people get taken to get processed by the police in order to pick them up. So I think people haven't really been talking about what you asked so much, but have been more concentrating on what can these neighborhood assemblies do, how can we stop them from getting co-opted, and how can we make our language clear, how can we be honest about who we think we are and how we're talking about ourselves as anarchists involved in these neighborhood assemblies. And I don't think people have figured it out yet, because this all still feels really new, but there's a lot of conversations happening.
So most of the protests were starting from were initiated by people from the Cégeps or from the universities. But how have secondary education or younger been involved in any of this?
I know some people who go, well, one person who goes to one high school in Montreal. I don't know too many high school students in Montreal. And some of the high schools ended up striking for a day against the tuition hikes. It's way harder to strike in a high school because the structures are different, like the organizing structures are different. There's like a student council instead of a student union, and they don't have a whole lot of power against their administration. And so there were picket lines at some of the high schools. They had a lot of fun with it. The person I talked to was really excited about having gotten to play her instrument outside of her school for a whole day.
So you were saying that there's a lot of criticism that's come from anarchists of student unionism and of being really, really process-oriented and process-heavy. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. First, a little bit about my context. I am not from Quebec. I'm not from Canada. I went to one of the elitist Anglophone universities in town. And so while I was in university, we were trying to get General Assemblies off the ground as a thing that could even happen at our university. There wasn't any history of it. People weren't that interested in doing it. And it was really hard to do. So I have a tendency to romanticize what happens at the Francophone universities. because I've never been involved in any sort of vibrant student unionism myself. But from what people have told me, sometimes the General Assemblies can be, they're really reliant upon rules of order, it's hard to figure out how to participate if you're new, and it's hard to be spontaneous about deciding to do different things. So those are some critiques that anarchists have brought up to me in terms of ways to stop myself from romanticizing this, these unions that happen, even though I do think that because of these structures that do exist, the strike is possible, but I'm sure the structures could be tweaked and changed and become more spontaneous for people when they need them. They aren't super flexible.
Do you see there being a lot of overlap between the what is becoming more generalized resistance and neighborhood assemblies and beyond outside of the student movement, between those needs and demands and then other causes that are being organized around in Montreal and Greater Quebec concerning... You had mentioned the decolonizing, the attempts at that, but what about no one is illegal organizing within the city? Is there much of an overlap, or are they two different tendencies and trajectories?
There's overlap in terms of people who are organizing. So Solidarity Across Borders is a big migrant justice group in Montreal. They held their annual anti-borders demo. No, it's Status for All. They call it their Status for All demo at the end of May. And people, this was like right after Law 78 got passed. Demos were huge. I was hoping that their demo would be huge. It's like usually really tiny. And not a lot of people care about folks who don't have papers, folks who are having a really hard time accessing all sorts of resources in Montreal. People are getting deported a lot. People are trying to take sanctuary to get papers. Like, it's really tough to not have papers in Canada these days. And there wasn't a huge crowd. There wasn't a huge surge from the student movement to go support people who don't have status. And that was disappointing in terms of people not being able to make the links between the connections between all of these different things that are happening. But then a lot of people who are involved in migrant justice organizing have also gotten involved in their neighborhood assemblies. So there were casseroles that were happening that were being called Status for All casseroles. I mean, people are adopting this casserole tactic. There was a really big action that happened in Montreal last week in solidarity with Algonquin folks in northern Quebec who were protesting resource extraction on their land and the government trying to throw off their leadership structure. And a couple hundred people came out. Like, it was pretty exciting. It was an action that only got called a week in advance, but it was in the form of a manifestation casserole kind of thing, and it drew on a lot of rhetoric from the student movement, but was about this group of Algonquins who are opposing resource extraction on their territory. So sometimes the links get made, sometimes they don't. It's hard to tell when it happens and when it doesn't. But yeah, I mean, there's other huge things happening in Canada in terms of the prison system changing a lot, and I don't think there's been a lot of connections. There was a call out for a neighborhood day of action with the neighborhood assemblies in the lead up to the student movement, or in the lead up to the start of the pickets again in August, and that's supposed to happen on August 10th, which is also Prisoner Justice Day in Canada, which is like a day that commemorates people who've died in prison. And the people who were writing, people who wrote the call out for that knew about Prisoner Justice Day and so included it in their call out. So, you know, people are trying to spread the word about different things that have always been happening in Montreal and radicalize the discourse in that way. But it's been hit and miss.
So we've been listening to a conversation with Maria, who is an anarchist, an American anarchist and former student who's been living in Montreal and participating in the student-led upheavals of late 2011 and early 2012. This is Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The Final Straw is supported by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, homemade baked goods, vegan sandwiches, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe. Next up, we're going to be hearing some coal country music. After producing last week's show with featuring an interview with Brian from Kitua Earth First about the recent action in Lincoln County in West Virginia to shut down a mountaintop removal site, I discovered a whole trove of really good Americana, country, and bluegrass music concerning worker struggles and community struggles against coal and against coal companies. So first up, we're going to hear Coal Tattoo by Hazel Dickens. That could be found on the album Coal Mining Women. And after that, we'll hear Jason and the Scorchers with Beat on the Mountain off of the soundtrack to Coal Country Music.
Somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head. Said that's a blue mark left by the coal. A little more and I'd have been dead. I like the rumble, I like the dark blood, I like the blue of the sleigh. But it's going down that new road looking for a job. Traveling and looking ahead. Traveling and looking ahead. Someday when I'm dead and gone, heaven, the land of my dreams, won't have to worry about losing my job, hard times and big machines. Won't have to pay my money away on dues and hospital plans. I'm gonna cut coal where the blue heavens roll. Sang with the angel band, sang with the angel band. Well, I'm traveling on down that coal town road. Listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye, White Sycamore. I'm leaving you behind.
I've been working in this mine since 1984. Just like my daddy did and his dad did before. I stand in line and ride that train down where I can't see. Trying to break down that wall of coal in front of me. The preacher tried to teach me what was wrong and right, but I learned all my lessons with a carbide light. Down where air is precious, where losers lose.
backers shut them down. The bosses brought the hard men in to run us out of town. How I love this mountain that my daddy's buried on. Every day I dig that coal he built his life upon. Well, some folks say that our way of life is out of time, but for now
the night is thick as silence. You can't cut it with a knife. A man lies in the hospital, draining out his life. The trucks are on the back road, in the dark the headlights shine. 'Cause there's one man dead on that Harlan County line. Oh, anger like poison is eating at your soul. Your thoughts are loud as gunfire, your face as hot as coal. Bitterness like buckshot explodes inside your mind. And there's one man dead on that Harlan County line. A miner's life is fragile, it can shatter just like ice. But those who bear the struggle have always paid the price. There's blood upon the contract like vinegar in wine. And there's one man dead on that Harlan County line. From the river bridge at High Splint to the Brookside Railroad track, you can feel a long strength building that can never be turned back. The dead go forward with us, not one is left behind. 'Cause there's one man dead on that Harlan County line, where the night is cold as iron, you can feel it in your bones. It sails like a shroud upon the grave of Lawrence Jones. Graveyard shift is walking from the bathhouse into the mine, and there's one man dead on that Harlan County line. One man dead on that Harlan County line. One miner dead on that Harlan County anymore.
I made this song about a boy who lived in my house. He started organizing working people in the union at 16. He was born and raised in Springfield, Massachusetts. He led an unemployed demonstration when he was 16 in Springfield. Later he went to Birmingham, Alabama, and worked amongst the white and black workers there, organizing for better conditions. When we had our trouble in Kentucky, he came up to Kentucky to help in the mine strike. And I got acquainted with him, and he held the first successful youth conference in the South. He was a friend. He got killed. I made this song about him. Hope you like it. Comrades, listen to my story. Workers, listen to my song. I'll tell you of a hero who's now dead and gone. I'll tell you of a worker whose age was just 19. He was the strongest union man that I have ever seen. Harry Sims, he was a pal of mine. We labored side by side, expecting to be shot on sight or taken for a ride by the dirty capitalist gun thugs who roam from town to town to shoot and kill our comrades wherever they may be found. Harry Sims and I was parted at 5 o'clock that day. Be careful, my dear comrade, to Harry I did say. I must do my duty, was his reply to me. If I get killed by the gun plugs, please don't grieve over me. Just remain a faithful worker, your comrade to be wise. Remain a faithful worker, your comrade to be wise. Help destroy this rotten system, don't fail to organize. He was walking up the railroad track one bright sunshiny day. He was young and handsome, and his step was light and gay. We did not know the gun thugs was waiting on the way to take our dear young comrade's life this bright sunshiny day. Harry Sims was killed on Brush Creek in 1932. He organized the miners in the good old MU. He fought for the union, that's all that he could do. He died for the union, also for me and you. Now, comrades, we must vow today, that one thing we must do. We'll organize all the miners in the good old NMU. We'll get 1 million volunteers for the YCL and sink this rotten system in the deepest pits of hell.
Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle. We know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun thugs a-looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? They say they have to guard us to educate their child. Their children live in luxury, our children almost wild. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Gentlemen, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a gun thug or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner. He's now in the Iron Sun. He'll be with you, fellow workers, till every battle's won. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Now all of you know which side you're on, and they'll never keep us down.
In that set, we started off with Coal Tattoo by Hazel Dickens off of the album Coal Mining Women. After that, we heard Beat on the Mountain by Jason and the Scorchers, which can be found on the soundtrack to Coal Country, a movie recently produced about struggles against coal in the Southeast. And that soundtrack can be found online under the title Coal Country Music. After that, we heard Lawrence Jones by Kathy Mattea off of her album Coal, and followed by Kathy Mattea's song The LNN Don't Stop Here Anymore, which is another song that comes off of that Coal Country soundtrack. After that, we heard The Death of Harry Sims, about a young labor organizer in a mining community. That can be found on the compilation Redneck March on Blair Mountain. Another song off of that album is Florence Reese's rendition of Which Side Are You On? Florence Reese wrote the song, and that song also appeared, in her performing it appears in the film Harlan County, USA, about struggles in Harlan County, Kentucky. This last track, the electronic track that you're hearing, or that you've been hearing throughout the show, is Carbon by V&V Nation off of their album Future Perfect. We're going to close out with Tom Breeding with the song The Longest Darkest Day off of the album The Unbroken Circle, Songs of the West Virginia Coal Fields. Have a great week.
My name's Clay Montgomery, sir, 38. No kids, no wife. From a family of nine, six work in the mine, but I won't live the miner's life. 'Cause I ain't going down in that cold, dark ground. I won't take their company pay. 'Cause I was 10 years old, but I still hear the sound of that longest, darkest day. Slate dams on that hill. Surveyor feared they might give way, probably said.